This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wild lands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Karen Garthwaite once again. She's acting public affairs specialist for Canyonlands National Park in southeastern Utah. Karen's been an interpretive park ranger with the National Park Service since 2004. She's been stationed here in Moab for 18 years, starting out as a park guide, giving walks and talks, and then supervising park guide teams and interns, and now overseeing the park's media work and exhibit projects. Canyonlands National Park is in southeastern Utah. It was established in 1964 and preserved over 500 square miles of high desert country through which flow the Green and Colorado rivers. So welcome once again, Karen. It's great to be
Thanks.
Back.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Let's talk today about wildlife. Let's start down at the river level. What kind of fish is found in the rivers? And what are native, what are introduced?
Well, I'm happy to talk about wildlife. I do want to first acknowledge that I am not a wildlife biologist. So in preparation for this interview, I went right on the park website and pulled down our species list, which I recommend highly if folks are interested in learning about what's out there. Because the fact of the matter is, when you visit Canyonlands, you're not going to see very much wildlife, but it's out there. But deserts are not an easy place to live. But anyhow, to get to your question, what kind of fish do we have? I was surprised when I went on our website to learn we have 33 total fish species.
I
found that interesting. Yep. Of those, there are three endangered species of fish in the Colorado River. Those are going to be the pike minnow, the bony tail chub, and razorback suckers. And there are ongoing monitoring projects that are done in the park in cooperation with the state of Utah, monitoring the populations of those endangered native species. And there's actually, just outside the park boundary, there's a nature conservancy property called the Matheson Preserve, which has a nursery site established for those razorback suckers, which is kind of awesome because it's just north of the park. So that's a really neat collaboration there that might help preserve that native population, perhaps even recover.
When the rivers are entering the park from the north, are they in a deep canyon or are they fairly much at land level?
So the rivers enter on both sides already entrenched into canyons. The width of the canyons varies substantially from top to bottom, but when you're down at the river level, they're typically a matter of hundreds to thousands of feet wide, versus at the top of the canyon where we're talking multiple miles across.
Talking back again about fish, are some species introduced or are they all native?
Oh, no, there are definitely non-native species in the rivers as well. I'm not a fisher person myself, so I would have to go back to that list if you want specific names. But I have heard of channel catfish, and I have heard of trout, various types being down there. Of course, the river bottoms themselves are extremely irregular because we're dealing with active geologic carving of these landscapes. You know, there might be long stretches that are sandy bottom and only 4 to 10 feet deep on average, but then you might hit a stretch where it's large boulders at the bottom and your feet go out from under you and it's over 100 feet deep. So that kind of variegated terrain at the bottom, I think, also helps support variegated fish habitat because of the, you know, different spawning environments and little micro habitats and water temperature changes throughout the length of the canyon.
Lake Powell is how far from the southern border of Canyonlands?
Well, technically, Canyonlands National Park abuts Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. which is the National Park Service unit that manages Lake Powell. So people who are doing the classic rafting trip through Cataract Canyon, recreating John Wesley Powell's adventures, right? Hopefully not the most adventurous boat flipping parts. But anyhow, when you come out of Cataract and you finish that last rapid, you're very quickly inside Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. And depending on the water level of Lake Powell, the atmosphere can change dramatically from a living, vibrant, moving river to a sediment-depositing lake.
Does the fact that there is Lake Powell there at the southern border of the park, has that affected what happens upstream? In other words, have there been fish in the lake that have moved upstream and into the river?
I am actually not aware of that specific impact. I will acknowledge that we do also have dams and lakes to the north of us, right? So Flaming Gorge Dam on the Green is north of Canyonland.
Right, right.
And so pulsing efforts that come out of that that dam and that flush down through the Green, you know, that activity has the potential to impact certain stretches of the park as well. But now I'm veering out on the edge of my knowledge in that game.
Okay. So what about frogs, toads, and salamanders? Are they found in the riparian areas adjacent to the rivers, or are they found further upstream?
So here's where the number didn't surprise me. We had 33 fish, but only 6 total.
Really?
Amphibian species.
Really?
Of those, the first 3 are toads, the red-spotted, great basin, spadefoot, and the woodhouse toad. And I have only seen those critters far away from the rivers, actually. I have seen them more in side channel pothole environments or intermittent stream beds. You know, they are capable of burrowing down into the sand and you know, waiting it out until that next thunderstorm comes, and they can hear the reverberation of the clap of thunder, and that's the signal for them to start digging with those amazing spade feet and start coming back up to the surface. Of course, we also have the American bullfrog, northern leopard frog, and the tiger salamander, and I do think those are more commonly seen closer to the riparian area. I've never seen any of them.
Are any of those toads found on the plateau level?
I have seen. Yeah, I've definitely seen those red-spotted toads just hopping around the slick rock at night.
And are any of those creatures found on the endangered species list?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
But if I'm wrong, hopefully you don't get too much hate mail about it.
So then, what kind of animals are found on the canyon walls?
Oh, well, the canyon walls are an interesting place, right? Because you can find critters who do make habitat there, like crevice roosting bats. We have an astoundingly diverse bat population here, and none of them are massive roosters. None of them are roosters at all. You know what I mean. We don't have big hibernacula filled with bats. Instead, they tend to be solitary, just roosting in like the crevices under some tree bark, or maybe right there in the canyon walls themselves. Of course, one of my favorite sounds of our desert soundscape is the canyon wren, whose call diminishes in tone. I've heard it described like the bird whose batteries are running out, because it's like, kee, 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 kee. But it just echoes through the canyons. Of course, there are also, wherever there might be a natural seep or spring that's coming out between 2 different rock layers in the wall, those can support whole hanging garden micro habitats with like maidenhair fern and beautiful wildflowers and all the little bees buzzing around and other natural pollinators and then the birds that are attracted. So those can be pretty exciting places if you find one on a trail to just sit and watch the interplay of the wildlife.
So what are the kind of birds do you find in the park?
Now, here's where the numbers get really impressive.
Yeah.
205 total bird species, including the Mexican spotted owl, which is definitely a federally listed threatened species.
Uh-huh.
And I've mentioned, you know, we do have things like, actually I didn't mention, but hummingbirds and swifts and swallows who will just be zipping around during the day. Those swifts and swallows love to play in the updraft currents by the cliff walls that just bring all those insects up with them, and they'll just be dive bombing over your head when you're out at a viewpoint and performing these incredible acrobatics all with their mouth open. just crazy to imagine traveling at 100 miles an hour with your mouth open.
Right.
And I wouldn't choose to do it, but that's how they get their lunch.
I guess it's a birder's paradise, huh?
I guess, yeah. But, of course, I got to say, the real star of the show in terms of bird life out here has got to be the raven. Ravens are the most commonly seen bird in the park, if not the most commonly seen animal, potentially, because they are incredibly well adapted to all of the habitats throughout the park, but they're also very well adapted to us.
Uh-huh.
And parking lots with trash cans and people dropping their granola bars.
Right.
Yeah. They're so intelligent and they're so capable of training their young with what they have learned. No joke, Jay. I have actually watched a raven and her offspring fly up to a tent. She grasped the tent zipper in her beak.
Really?
Walked horizontally for 4 feet to open that zipper.
Wow.
And then put her head under to hold it up so she and her offspring could hop inside and eat all the treats.
No kidding. Wow, that's fascinating.
It's fascinating. It's also horrifying.
Yeah.
In some regard, because it reminds us that the responsibility is really on us when we are recreating in these wild places,
right,
that we've got to be cognizant that we're in somebody's backyard and prevent them from eating the foodstuffs that could actually be quite damaging. You know, wild animals are smart, but they may not know the difference between the peanut butter sandwich and the plastic bag it came in.
Yeah.
And that plastic bag can be fatal.
All right. All right.
But, man, are they entertaining to watch.
All right. Well, I've known of the intelligence of ravens. I never heard of opening a tent up with a zip by pulling the zipper.
I didn't believe it until I saw it.
So what about snakes and lizards?
Goodness. Yes, we do have both. I'll start with the lizards because they're definitely more frequently seen. They're only about 11 species. But I feel like any hike you take spring through fall, you're going to see way more than 11 lizards. They are all over the place. They're extremely well adapted to this desert, and they can be active all day long. They will take use of shade, for sure, but they're a fun thing to watch for. As far as snakes goes, we do have 9 species of snake. Only one of them is venomous. And it's pretty infrequently spotted. My 18 years here, I think I've probably seen maybe 10 midget faded rattlesnakes. That's the name of the species. They're called midget because they're only about 20 inches long and about as big around as your thumb.
Yeah.
So they're little guys, and they're not very brightly colored, so that's the midget faded. They're kind of the same coloring as a prairie rattler, but dustier, not as brilliant.
How serious is a bite from one of those snakes?
In my 18 years, I have never heard of someone being bitten by one.
Really?
Oh. So I can't give you a personal accounting of that. It's, like I said, they're very infrequently seen. They're slightly more frequently heard, right?
Yeah.
You hear the rattle, and then you just don't go in that direction.
And they're found at the plateau level?
They are, yeah, yeah. But our temperature changes so dramatically throughout the day.
Uh-huh.
you know, some of the park is up at 6,000 feet, but even the lowest elevation is only about, it's still about 4,000 feet. So we're definitely susceptible to winter freezing and snow. So critters like, you know, rattlesnakes are going to be down in burrows for months throughout the winter. Come spring, they're going to start being more active, but our temperatures can change 40 degrees in a day. So they're going to have their sweet spot of warming in the morning, and then they're going to go off and do their thing, and then it's going to get too warm for them. They'll go back down to a burrow. So they're really only narrow windows of time when they're active, as far as I've seen, and not predominantly in places where people are hiking frequently.
When we were talking about birds, I meant to ask you, do you have roadrunners in the park?
I have never seen a roadrunner in the park. Now, you made me curious. I want to look and see if they have ever been documented, because I know they have been spotted in the Moab area.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't guarantee if they've been in the park.
Oh.
Good question. You stumped the ranger. Congratulations.
Well, I know roadrunners are found in the area surrounding the park. They're found in Southern California and in Arizona and so on. So.
Oh, and they're definitely in Utah. Yeah, St. George is covered with them.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to look it up while we're talking. I'll just have my little list coming up in the background, and I'll let you know.
Okay. Well, let's talk about mammals. What kind of mammals do you find in the park, if you can find them?
Well, I appreciate that you said if you can find them, because that means you've been hearing what I'm saying.
Right.
So, yes, we do have 55 total mammal species.
Really?
And that does include some apex predators. We have documented mountain lion sightings in the park. We have black bears that routinely come in to the southern district, the Needles section. There's a little mountain range just to the south of the park, and they'll come straight down the drainages on Forest Service land and then cross right into the park. So if you're backpacking down there, you need to have a bear-proof canister for your food.
Is that a forested area?
Pardon me?
Is that a forested area in the park?
So,
Needles?
Forested. Let's unpack that word. I'm a native Californian, so I grew up with the redwoods.
Yeah.
As, like, trees. So our trees here in Utah might be taller than me, and I'm 5'4". So I jest, but we do have stretches of kind of like a scrub forest. We have the pinyon, which is a pine, a two-needle pine, as well as the Utah juniper as the two dominant tree species in large stretches of the park, actually. They just don't get very tall because we don't get very much water. On average, it's 8 to 10 cubic inches, which if you think about a water bottle, that's like 2 inches at the bottom of your Nalgene for an entire year's precipitation. So it helps make sense why our trees stay small, because they're slow growing. They might be 500, 800 years old, but only 12 feet tall. And thinking then about the mammal life in the park, it also pays to be small when you're dealing with that level of low precipitation, but then also low vegetation related to that, right? So most of those 55 mammal species are going to be teeny little guys like
rodents,
many, many, many species of rodents,
right?
Most of which are nocturnal. We do have a fairly gregarious squirrel that I would say is maybe the most frequently seen mammal for people hiking in the park. It's called the white-tailed antelope squirrel.
Oh, really?
It does not have horns. I believe it's called antelope because that white tail is kind of reminiscent of a pronghorn's rump.
Right.
Of course, people call pronghorn a pronghorn antelope. But what I love about the white-tailed antelope squirrel is when it's in direct sunlight, it flips that white tail up over its back, kind of like a dainty, furry little parasol. They're out running around, going from shade patch to shade patch, and they're incredibly well-adapted to the heat of this desert. Their internal body temperature can range 10 degrees without them starting to experience heat stress. which is just astounding, right? If we went from an internal body temperature of 98.7 to 108.7, we'd be dead. So it's just remarkable what their little bodies can do in this desert landscape. It's a good reminder that we are not designed for this place. So human beings have to take a lot of precautions when we're the dominant mammal walking around in the landscape. We need lots of water and sunscreen and hats.
Yeah. And your hot season is what, March to late October?
Well, yeah, I appreciate that you listed March there because everybody's hot is different. So if 80 degrees sounds like hot for you, then it can hit 80 in April for sure. I have also seen it snow in April, and that was actually the same year. So spring can be quite varied for us. But once we start getting into May and then into June, temperatures in the 80s and 90s are common. By late June, July, we're hitting over 100.
Uh-huh.
That southern district of the park does benefit a little bit from the breezes coming down off that nearby mountain range, but I believe they can hit probably 105, 110 down there. But then it might drop to 55, 60 at night.
Uh-huh.
So that's that crazy temperature swing I was mentioning.
Well, at 6,000 feet, I would guess so.
Yeah. And then by late summer, traditionally, we would have a monsoon season that could come anywhere between July and October. And historically, that does tend to bring large volume, short duration rainfalls. I'm using this kind of language, though, because one of the things we're seeing with climate change is a change in that precipitation pattern, which is tough for us for predicting, but it's also, you know, just really tough on the vegetation and the wildlife.
So what are you anticipating in regard to climate change? And is the park doing anything to accommodate that?
Well, we are anticipating continued drought. We're in a over 20-year documented drought at this point throughout this region. We're imagining, even if precipitation stays the same, the increase in temperature will result in an overall drier environment because of that increased evaporation and transpiration, right? So then it becomes like a compounded effect. Longer growing season could also mean plants are using more water, and that's going to lead to further soil aridity.
Will that affect wildlife as well?
It very well could. You know, if certain species of grass are not able to survive as well as others, and that is some ongoing research that we're documenting. There are cool season grasses and warm season grasses here, and it does seem like a shift is maybe starting to occur in where those different species are able to thrive and where they're starting to struggle. And then any wildlife that relies upon the seeds of those grasses would certainly be impacted.
Right. So
one thing I want to mention about climate change, though, we have reached out to our tribal nation partners to learn some traditional methods for managing resources that might help with the mitigation of some impacts of climate change. Specifically, I'm talking about the natural springs that are found throughout the park. Any place that there's naturally occurring water here would have been absolutely essential for the indigenous cultures who once lived in this landscape, and their descendants are in our communities, or just to the south. So it's kind of an exciting time right now where the park is actively reaching out to tribal nation partners in an attempt to start listening and learning about some of that traditional ecological knowledge in a way that it might actually help the science-based management of these park resources.
And who are your native tribes that you're involved with, and the Navajo and Paiute?
Oh, actually, Canyonlands National Park has over 20 traditionally associated federally listed tribes. Yeah, you mentioned Navajo Nation. We also have Hopi Tribe, Zuni Tribe, Paiute and Ute, multiple bands of Paiute and Ute, multiple Pueblos, Pueblo of Acoma, Jemez, Pohoake, San Ildefonso. I'm not going to be able to recite them all. There are plenty in number, as well as multiple bands of Ute, Southern Ute, Ute Mountain Ute, all of whom kind of surround this region in terms of where reservation land might have been established, but the landscape that is now Canyonlands was absolutely part of the traditional landscape occupied and traveled by these people or their ancestors.
All right. Are you having to deal with any invasive plants or even animals?
Oh, yes.
About you, Chris?
Yeah. You know, I may have mentioned, I think it was in the last episode, that large segments of Canyonlands National Park were once grazed.
Yeah.
And a lot of that previously grazed area is now, I'm not going to say covered in cheatgrass, but I will say susceptible. And cheatgrass is prevalent in many of those stretches. We actually do have a couple little pocket areas within the park that, because of the complexity of the canyons surrounding them, those pockets could never be grazed. And so they present interesting research opportunities or monitoring opportunities to see how those invasive species may or may not get a foothold in a place that didn't experience that kind of earlier impact.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the river corridors and every possible little mini stream that comes down into the river corridors has just been propagated by tamarisk.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you know, tamarisk came in as an ornamental, non-native, and then just took over the entire Colorado Plateau. And it's an extremely thirsty shrub, and it's an extremely prolific shrub in terms of the airborne seeds that it puts out. And it can really take over and knock back the ability of native species like willows to propagate along that river corridor. And then, of course, the third one I got to mention is some people's favorite Western plant, because it's in every John Wayne movie they've ever seen. They might be surprised to hear that tumbleweeds are an invasive.
Right, they are.
They do not belong in this landscape, even though they did arrive right around the same time as a lot of those John Wayne epics were set, those late 1800s. And they can really choke up a trail. In spring, when we get our big gusting winds that come through, the tumbleweeds just come like a mass migration across the road and can really just choke up a trailhead or a narrow passage of trail. Makes for some pretty scratchy bushwhacking.
Mm.
My least favorite hiking season.
Aaron, I hate to tell you, but we've run out of time once again. So, it's been great to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Well, I enjoy it, too, and that's what happens when you let an interpreter take the mic. We talk a lot.
Great. Our guest today has been Karen Garthwaite. She's acting public affairs specialist for Canyonlands National Park in southeastern Utah. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.com or buzzsprout.com, and or visit our website at jswilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.